And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, where I think I have to be done living in the 90s now that The Last Dance is over. But if I'm going to spend 6 weeks in the 90s, I'm damn well going to end it with one of the figures from sports, not just basketball, in the 90s. One of the best analysts in the world doing anything, the best presence on television in sports, the one and only Charles Barkley. How are you?
Man, thanks for the kind words. I am doing awesome. It's been really, really weird the last 2 months. I mean, you know, going back to high school and college and anything, this is the longest I've ever had to stay down, man. It's been very interesting, but I still wish everybody safety out there, but I'm doing great.
I'm glad to hear it. So we've all been living in the 90s. You obviously have been close with Michael for a long time. You faced him in the finals. And so here's my first question. I want to start there. In either 1993, when you faced Michael and the Bulls in the finals, or 1998, when you didn't, but you're obviously still in the league and close with him, in either of those instances, did you know with some level of certainty that he was going to retire?
A private conversation, I knew the first time, and I knew the second time. I knew both times from a private conversation, yes.
I think the
first one was, you know, all the stuff going on with his dad and everything. I think that had a lot to do with it. But the second one, for sure, I knew beforehand.
Did knowing that make the finals different or stranger for you? Or were you able to just sort of like, you know, let's just play the finals and you didn't think about it at all?
Well, you know, I didn't find out till later after we played them in the finals.
Okay.
So the finals were just awesome. And I've said before, probably my biggest regret is I did not have my team ready to play in game one. The lights were too big for us, and I blame myself for that. And that was one thing that was interesting about watching the documentary. Michael said the exact same thing, and we had never talked about it before. He said the exact same thing after game one against the Lakers, and which that was the only game they lost that series. And that's the game one was the only game we played bad. But it was really weird that we both had the same, like, man, the lights are different. And that's I was not more aggressive in game one. That's probably my biggest regret about probably my entire career.
Well, I was looking back and reading a couple, some clips from that series. And you, after game one, KJ has a rough first couple of games of the finals, Kevin Johnson. And after game one, you go out of your way to sort of tell the media, can you just back off this dude? Like, it's the finals. It's like one bad game. We're going to move on. So do you remember even sensing right then that you lose game one at home? KJ has a subpar game. The media is going to be, I mean, it's the finals. There's a million media there. You felt the need to sort of preemptively say, let's back off for a second. It's one game.
Well, you know, Zach, it's my team. I'm going to take the good with the bad. So I was always going to protect my teammates no matter what, even going back to Philly when we had good teams and crap teams. You know, that's just the way this thing works. You know, the star gets a lot of credit. He gets pretty much all the blame. But and I was, listen, playing 8 years in Philly, wasn't nothing going to shock me as far as people said anything bad about me or whatever. So, yeah, I went out to the media early in that series like, yo, man, we in the finals. We had a rough game one. Like I said, that's the only bad game we played. If you go back and look at the series.
Can you? So I had Danny Ainge on my podcast last week, and so I rewatched portions of that series. I had forgotten. Obviously, I remember the Paxson shot. I remember game six being close. I had forgotten in the last 2 minutes, you guys are up four, how many chances you had to put that game away or to go up six, including with about a minute 45, you back Horace down and flick up a nice little like 7 foot jump hook that for you, MVP Charles, is probably like a 65% shot. And I think it's just long. Can you close your eyes and see those last 2 minutes? Does it still haunt you? Or is it just like, that's basketball, it happens, we lost?
No, I think the only thing that disappoints me, listen, missing shots are part of the game. You know, the only thing that bothers me about that series is, you know, we didn't stop them. They scored three times in a row. We had the lead, and they got three baskets in a row. If I remember correctly, we gave up two layups to Michael before Pax hit the three. So not getting a defensive stop, it was the difference in the game.
The Pax three, you're guarding Scotty on that play, and you lunge for a steal at the top of the key, and you don't get it. At the top of the arc, and you don't get it. And that sort of starts the chain of events that leads to Scotty drive, Horace pass out to Pax. I have to go back and watch it. Do you remember how close you were? Did you, obviously you didn't plan for that to happen, but you saw something in that moment. Like, I might be able to get this. And you got to go for it, right? You can't play scared.
No, when you look at, I had studied the Bulls all season. When I first got to Phoenix, I had told them, we're going to the finals, we're going to play the Bulls. I remember telling Jerry Colangelo and Cotton Fitzsimmons that, I said, listen, ain't nobody in the Western Conference close to me. I got Dan Marley, Kevin Johnson. We're going to the finals, and we're going to play the Bulls. So I would study Bulls games throughout the season and make mental notes. So I'd seen that play probably three times. So the play was going to be, they threw it to Michael. So I'm saying to myself, ain't but two guys on the court got balls to shoot this shot. I says, Michael going to shoot it. And Pax got shoot. There's nobody else out there going. They got the stones to shoot it. So the play was going to be, they were going to throw it to Scotty and have Michael coming at us full speed. So I'm like, I'm not going to let that happen. So he's got his back to me, and he's getting ready to throw it to Michael, because Michael coming at us full speed is a nightmare.
Yes.
So I jumped it so he couldn't throw to Michael. I still wasn't concerned, because Scotty could have went and shot that, but I wasn't worried about that. Even he passed to Horace, he wasn't going to shoot it either. And the only mistake we made was leave, like I say, because you got to understand, we had a two-point lead at the time.
Yep.
So I wasn't worried about it. If Scotty scores, we got the lead, we got a tie ball game and the ball. As Horace scores, we got a tie and we got the ball. But, you know, like I say, you know, Ainge left, Pax. It was, you know, that's the way you play defense. But I had a different agenda in my head. I'm like, hey, ain't but one guy going to shoot this ball. And like I say, I wasn't worried about Scott and Horace, who both pretty could have had close to layups, but they wasn't going to shoot it, and we left Pax.
Well, Danny told me, the irony of it, Danny told me he was the one, as you guys were in the huddle and leaving the huddle, saying, no threes, no threes, no threes, no threes. I must have said it 10 times. And then we start to play, and I leave Paxson, and they get a three.
Yeah, you know, and like I say, I don't blame Danny, because he made, like, a basketball play. But, like I say, I had already scouted that play out throughout the season. I said, I'm not going to have Michael coming at us full speed. That's not because he had, because I was already screwed, because if I remember correctly, he had just did it two times in a row and got layups. And that third time, I said, man, I'm not going to let this happen again. So I jumped the play. I was not worried about anybody. I said, if they shoot a two, we got 5 seconds to go on the ball. We're still in great shape. But, you know, unfortunately, hey, we left Pax, and it is what it is.
Let's talk about the trade to Phoenix. So Philly, you have your career with Philly. I mean, you have written a book about your career with Philly. You come in with a group of legends. The legends all gradually leave one by one, including the Moses Malone trade is like an all-time underrated disaster trade. I mean, it's like you can't make a worse trade than that.
Well, you know, what really screwed up my entire career, to be honest with you. So I remember – you know, I'm starting to become a star my third year. I think I was an all-star that year, and I think that might be one of the years I was leading the league in rebounds. So I'm feeling great about myself for the next 10 years. And Doc is retiring. Moses is getting old. They had already traded Maurice, and we got the number one pick in the draft. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have Brad Daugherty for the next 10 years or more. We're going to be contenders. I'm feeling really, really good. As a matter of fact, the night before the draft, me and some of the guys went out and celebrated. I mean, like I say, Brad, it would have been awesome to play with Brad.
Yeah.
And we had a great night. I remember getting a phone call about 6 in the morning. This is day of the draft, I might add. It was from a guy named Phil Jasner in Philadelphia. And Phil calls me. He says, Charles, can you talk? I said, Phil, it's like 6 in the morning. He says, the Sixers made a trade. You need to talk about it. I need your opinion. I said, what they do? He says, traded the number one pick in the draft. I said, hey, Phil, this is no time to be joking. Nobody's that stupid to trade the number. And he says, yep. I said, Phil, let me take a shower and I'll call you right back. And I called him back. And I said, what's going on, man? He says, well, it gets worse. I said, oh, how can it be worse than trading the number one pick in a draft? He said, well, you traded number one pick to Houston, to Cleveland for Roy Hinson. I said, what? That's all we got for the number one pick was Roy Hinson? And then he says, oh, and they traded Moses to Washington. I said, wait, Moses was going to be a great mentor because Moses was like a dad to me. He was my mentor. And he's going to be a great mentor for Brad Daugherty. So that was the beginning of the end. Like, I could have actually had a really good team. Like, we struggled the next 2 years before I got Jaminski and Mahorn, and we won a couple series here or there. But yeah, like, but losing Brad Daugherty, and even Moses, if we keep Moses, because Moses ended up playing like another 4 or 5 years.
He made two All-Star teams after that trade.
That wrecked my entire Philadelphia career. Like, no Brad Daugherty, no Moses. And Rulon, we traded him for Rulon and Cliff Robinson. And Rulon never played with me because of his knee. And that was one of the worst disasters of my – that was the biggest disaster of my career, plain and simple.
And it's not the Cliff Robinson that some fans will know. It's the other older Cliff Robinson that fans probably don't know that are listening to this podcast. So you get traded. So then it just goes bad, and you make clear to the Sixers you would like to be elsewhere.
So that's not what happened. That's one of the big lies that I demanded to be traded.
I didn't say demanded.
So we trade for Mahorn and Jaminski, and we have a couple of decent years. We have Derek Smith. We win a series. We lose to the Bulls. And then they let Jaminski go. They let Mahorn go. And I'm there by myself again. Johnny Dawkins had blew out his knee. And for 3 straight years, I'm on the cover of every sports magazine talking about getting traded. And I'm like, it's frustrating. I remember one Sport News had a picture of me on the cover one time of me in 6 different uniforms.
Yeah.
But that was just stressful. So then I tell you this funny story. My agent calls me one morning and he says, hey, you're going to get traded to the Lakers today. And me and my friends, we go out and celebrate and get drunk about noon. So he calls me that morning, calls me later. He said, hey, you're going to get traded to the Lakers. They're going to finalize the deal and I'll get back to you. So we go out and celebrate and I'm on cloud nine. He calls me back 3 hours later. It's like 3:30 now. He said, the Sixers backed out the deal. And I'm drunk as and we got a game that night.
And I've heard a version of this story before.
I'm like, what? What are you talking about? He's like, the Sixers were scared to pull the trigger. And I said, you kidding me? I said, dude, we got a game tonight. And I've been drinking since noon. and the one thing that's funny, I don't even know how I played that night. I think I might have played bad because I was so angry. I was so angry that the Sixers didn't pull the trigger. And then it was just suffering the next 2 or 3 years. So the thing that was funny, so in Phoenix, I'm starting to play golf now. So we in Phoenix, I ordered a set of Ping golf clubs.
Okay.
So this is the middle of the summer. I'm on trial in Milwaukee for punching old boy, who deserved to be punched, I might add.
And we're going to talk about this too.
So I get acquitted. Mm-hmm. Rightfully so. We're flying back to Philly. I'm buying drinks for everybody on the plane because we all in coach. There wasn't no first class. I'm buying everybody on the plane drinks. And we get back to my house. This is a Friday night. My golf clubs are sitting on my front porch. I got my attorney with me. I said, hey, man, write me this letter telling the Sixers I ain't never coming back here again. I'm sick of all the rumors, blah, blah, blah. He said, hey, you're in a good mood. We had a great weekend court. Let me wait to send the letter. I said, okay. And then, like, Monday, I get a call from the Sixers. I've been traded to the Suns.
Crazy. So let me follow up on that. So the Milwaukee thing, for people who don't know, you're out at a bar and some guy or multiple guys are being to you and the person you're with, and they're provoking. It's even worse than that, I think, right?
No. So I'm in a bar with two of my friends who are still great friends today, Larry Krystowiak and Frank Rakowski.
Oh my God, what a crew! That's a early '90s, late '80s NBA crew right there.
Those two guys are two of the best guys I ever met. So we're out, and we had a place called Rosie's. I think that's Rosie's. So it's closing time, and Frank, and that day we flew commercial, so we were leaving in like 2 to 3 hours, and I'm not going to go back to bed for an hour. So Frank says, hey, come back to my condo and have a drink. I said, yeah, that'd be good. I can go straight to the bus. So he said, hey, ride with my wife, because she parked a good bit away. So we start walking. And it seemed like, first of all, it's snowing. And it seems like nobody's on the street but us two. So we get about a block from Rosie's. And all of a sudden, I could hear running. And then it started getting closer to me. And I could hear him saying, Charles Barkley, Charles Barkley. So I said, hey, girl, we need to speed up. I could hear people running toward me, but it's really cold. I didn't want to stop and turn around. So we start walking faster. And we get like, because she had to park a long way away, you know, not a lot of parking there, block. So we get about two blocks away, and these three guys are up on me. And I'm like, yo, man, what's y'all problem? They're like, we don't like you. We don't like you, and we're going to kick your ass. I said, why are y'all going to kick my ass? I don't even know you dudes from Benny. They're like, no, we don't like you. And the old girl's screaming. I'm screaming at her, hey, shut up. I'm trying to think over here. So I got three. Actually, they were three big weightlifters, and they're right in my grill. Two up my back, one's right in my grill. I said, yo, man, I don't want no trouble. And the dudes say, like, I'm going to kick your ass. So I'm starting to think, okay, what are you going to do? Because right now you're probably going to get your ass kicked. So then I started thinking like, okay, make them think you're crazy. So I started taking off all my clothes. I take off my jacket. I had a big coat on. I take off my shirt. I take off my shoes and socks. And I started doing, I think it was right around the time we were doing Karate Kid. I was like, wax on, wax off. And I'm doing this all of a sudden. These two dudes back up, but this one dude is still in my grill. And I'm thinking like, it's working on two of them, but it's not working on another one. And then I said, I might as well make my move. So I hit this one dude as hard as I can hit a dude. And he went down, and he's like, you can hit me. I said, you damn right. And there's plenty more where that came from.
There you go.
And thank goodness those other two guys, because it would have been an interesting proposition, me trying to fight these three big guys. They had all got on me at the same time. So when I hit old boy, he went down, and that was it. So I get back to the hotel. I said, hey, just drop me off at the hotel. I don't feel like going back to y'all place. So I'm in my room sitting on my bed probably 45 minutes later, and the coach knocks on the door. I hear a knock. He says, Chuck, you in there? I said, yep, what's going on? He says, what you do tonight? I said, I went out with Bukowski and Krystowiak. We had a great time. He said, well, some guy saying you punched him because he asked for an autograph, and he's saying you punched him for no reason, and the police are here to arrest you. And they took me to jail. That's the actual true story.
So I give you lots of credit all across the story, but one of the things I really do give you credit for is you took it to trial. And you were offered, you can play, according to what I read, you were offered, you can plead down to like some community service. And you said, I'm taking this to trial. I'm innocent. And, like, look, that's a scary thing to do.
Well, my thing was, yo, man, I'm not giving these dudes no money. I didn't do anything wrong. I see, if these dudes had to beat me to a pulp, I'd be Charles Barkley with his ass kicked. And it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be a story. It'd be like, you know, whatever. And I says, these dudes walk up on me, run up on me, and I'm not doing anything. I said, we ain't settling. We ain't giving them no money. We're going to court. But the thing that was really funny when we were telling this story in court, because, you know, so, you know, everybody lies in court. So I'm sitting there, and these three guys, and they all neatly dressed now with big old arms and short sleeve shirts on, big old weightlifters. And they're like, yeah, we met him at Rosie. We were big fans. And, you know, we asked him for autographs, and he was rude. He wouldn't sign autographs. And I'm like, yo, man, these dudes are lying. He said, Charles, everybody know they're lying. The truth will come out. And I'm getting mad at my attorney. I'm saying, I need Judge Judy at this damn point. I'm like, these two just lying on the witness stand. And then when the truth comes out, the jury's laughing. The judge is laughing. They're like, because there was a guy. I didn't even notice this guy. There was a parking lot attendant in the parking lot. I didn't even know him from Adam. He said, yeah, I saw this big black guy getting undressed in the snow, and I thought it was something wrong with him. I mean, it was snowing, it was freezing. And
It's fair. It's a fair assessment.
Yeah, and I was like, yo, man, I was trying to improvise. I got three dudes standing right in front of me. I'm like, I want them to think I'm crazy.
Now, listen, the reason I bring this story up is Phoenix, I think the Suns were very closely monitoring that trial. And I believe if the news accounts from that time are right, the same day you're acquitted, the Suns trade for you. And I think those two events are related, because I think if you're not acquitted, I don't know if Phoenix is like, you know what, there's just too much going on here. We don't want to do this trade. I believe those happen on the same day. Dude, that's what the news accounts say. Do you read? Because that's a hell of a day if those things happen on the same day for you.
Well, I don't know the aspect of that, to be honest with you, because, you know, I was in court for like, I think 3 days. So I was going court, dinner, back to court. Which was interesting, and I've told this story. No, I haven't actually told. I think maybe once at a time. So the summer before, I fly to Portland, Oregon. So the Blazers have a terrific team, but when they got four or five All-Stars, and they got probably the defense bench in the league. So in the middle of the summer, I fly to Portland and meet with the general manager. I can't remember his name right now. We talked about it on the show a couple years ago, and the Trailblazers sent me a check. I said, they owe me $1,275. That's the number. It was right around there. They owe me from flying to Philadelphia to Portland. I said, yeah, because Portland was my first choice, because Portland had enough talent to give up for me, and we still be a contender. They had lost to the Bulls in the finals. But they were loaded, man, top to bottom. But the one thing they didn't have is a half-court game. Like, they were great as long as the game was going up and down. I said, I'd be the final piece to the puzzle. So I flew out there, spent about 3 hours with the general manager. I said, look, these are all the players on your team here. You give up three or four of these guys, we still going to have the nucleus to be contenders. He thought about it, called me the next day. Because I flew out there, met with him, and flew back, something like that. And he called me the next day, and he said, Charles, we're going to stick with our guys. And I said, you know, man, y'all not going to win, because the game's going to slow down in the fourth quarter. And you're going to need a low-post guy. And I said, I'm going to be better for anybody you got. I'm going to be the best rebounder you got, so you guys going to be able to run even more. But that's the only time I personally heard got involved in my own negotiations.
So, the Phoenix thing is interesting to me, and the Milwaukee incident, because in light of having just watched The Last Dance, you and Michael ascend at the same time to almost the same heights in the NBA, and you make very different choices about what that is going to mean for you personally. Michael chooses to, I'm going to hunker down with the people that I trust, and I can't I'm too famous to ever live a normal life anymore. So I'm going to isolate in my hotel room, hang out with my guys, hang out with my security guys. You make a conscious choice. As famous as I get, I am still – you can't live a normal life. But if I want to go out to drink at a bar, I'm going to go out to drink at a bar. You go to the – you're on the dream team. You decide, you know what? I'm in Spain. I stand out in Spain. I'm going to walk up and down La Rambla and go to bars and meet people. And, like, there's a price that you paid for that. And the price that you paid for it is incidents like what happened in Milwaukee, because you don't know what drunken strangers are going to do to you. You don't know what – but you made that choice. And I bet you're really thrilled that you did, right, because those experiences are what they are.
Well, I didn't look at it like that, Zach, because let's be realistic. I think that was – I played for 16 years. I think there were probably – only real 3, 4, maybe 5 incidents in 16 years. So I actually think, you know, so see, that's one thing that annoys me about fans. Most of the fans are fantastic. I mean, in my 16 years, NBA, 19 years on television, man, you meet some of the coolest people. Some of the best fans are friends of mine today. So I think sometimes they get a bad rap when there's a incident. I said, but, man, most of the people I met during my career have been amazing. But to get back to your original question, is, man, what's better than being Charles Barkley or Michael Jordan or Karl Malone or John Stockton or LeBron or Kobe? And if you can't enjoy that, like going out, yeah, sometimes it's a pain. But if you're not going to enjoy it, like my life ain't never – gonna be as better as fun or as better as it was when I was Charles Barkley. I mean, you know, you're looking at the Last Dance, you know, yeah, it was hectic and it was a pain, but, you know, deep down you gotta just say to yourself, like, man, that was pretty damn good to be Michael Jordan. Like, it ain't gonna get like LeBron, who's the best player in the world today, probably, like, he might get older and he might do some good things. But deep down, he got to say, man, when I was LeBron James, it was pretty damn special. And I've always believed that. Ain't nothing better than when right now, everybody pretty much in the world knows LeBron. Everybody is, so that's a pretty good feeling.
So I just find it interesting. So you, I don't want to belabor this, but you have talked about how your relationship with Michael has changed. And part of the reason that's happened is, you very truthfully and correctly said on television, I think one of the reasons that the Hornets have struggled or have can't get out of their own way is that Michael really essentially hires only his friends and his family and his buddies to run the team. And like, they've got to start thinking outside that North Carolina Jordan associate box. And I've always criticized them for the same thing because it's true. And then you watch this. And I think if you try to empathize in terms of 1993, the gambling stuff comes out and everyone's all over him. His father is murdered. And I can see, like, okay, the whole world is descending on me. I can only trust, like, I'm going to just pull in and I can only trust this group of guys. And and you project that outward 25 years or whatever. And that's how he runs the Hornets. And going back and seeing it all and being reminded of it all, I almost felt empathy for, like, I get why this guy is only trusting this group of guys, even if it's to the detriment of his team. And I'm not saying that those guys are bad at their jobs. I'm just saying, like, they haven't won games and it always helps to have outside perspectives and all that. But I can draw a line, I think, from Michael's experiences starting in 93 when fame sort of goes bad on him a little bit to what you said, which was totally correct about how he runs the Hornets. Does that make any sense to you?
To a certain degree, but at some point you have to change. You have to be like, you know, maybe because I think the toughest thing about being famous is the people around you. Okay. You have to really be careful who's around you. And sometimes you make bad decisions. Sometimes you make good decisions. And if when you make a bad decision, you have to cut that person loose because, you know, you're paying all the bills. You're buying all the dinners. You know, they're flying around in your private jet. But if things aren't working, you have to make a change. I mean, I think he has a track record long enough as an executive, like, okay, what I'm doing is not working. Because You know, Zach, I tell people one thing about sports. It's hard to fail at sports. What I mean by that is we're the only profession in the world. Well, we tell you, you suck, and we're going to let you pick the best new guy. You know, and that's 100% true. I mean, like, if you're a good lawyer, when you come out of law school, you're going to go to the best law firm. When you're a doctor, you're going to go to the best hospital. That stuff is shaded like that. But in sports, every year, not 1 year, not 2 years or 5 years, every year, if we say, okay, you don't have a good team, but we got a fresh new crop coming in and you get to go first. It's really difficult to not to have some success, really. And I think now, I think you really have to be careful who you hire, because I need somebody who's looking at a 17, 18-year-old kid now. And like, so, or a guy who's only been in college for 6 months. So I need to hire people around me. Like, I would do my hiring like this. I say, hey, I need a big man. I need a guard. Okay, tell me what this guard do well. Tell me what he doesn't do well. The big man to do the exact same thing. But I got to hire people around me who know exactly what they're looking for. That's just my perspective, because it's harder to draft players now, because you only get them for – you were getting them out of high school at one point, and or now you're getting them out to college after 6 months. So the people you have around you, they really have to be good at their job.
Do you – you've said in a prior interview I read that sometimes you feel bored at Inside the NBA. You've talked about working – being a GM, running a team. You've talked about running for governor of Alabama. Do either of those things still resonate with you as possible post-TNT career paths?
Well, I'm not going to do the governor thing, because I think both of these parties are crap, and they do nothing for actual people. The Democrats and the Republicans are both full of crap. You see now with this pandemic – they're not doing anything for these people. Now, I was very disappointed I didn't get the job 2 years ago. You know, first of all, I thought I should have got the job.
In Phoenix, right?
No, in Orlando.
In Orlando.
No, I thought I should have got the job. They were great to me to a certain degree, but I thought I should have got the job, to be honest with you. They went a different direction. I think I'd be great at the job. Because I'm smart enough to hire people who know what they're doing. You know, when they finally came down to it, they wanted to help me hire people. I said, that's not going to happen. I said, I'm going to hire. And they're like, well, you don't have any experience. I said, well, I got enough experience to hire the right people. Because I says, who you think know more basketball people, me or you guys? And I says, I guarantee you, I know every basketball player or basketball personnel for the last 30 to 5 years. So I'm going to hire a great staff. I said, because the one thing I'm not going to do is let you guys make decisions for me and these guys crush me on television. That's not going to happen. If I fail, it's going to be me. It ain't going to be like, well, Charles is the president, but the general manager is making all the draft pick. I said, that's just not going to happen for me. I said, I want complete control. And if I fail, I'm cool with that. I said, but I'm never going to let other people make basketball decisions for me, period.
Let's go rapid fire through some things. What's your close your eyes and see it flashbulb memory of the famous Monte Carlo dream team scrimmage? What's your best memory from that? You're on Magic's team, so you lose. You're on the losing team.
Yeah, but listen, I think that stuff is so embellished for this Last Dance thing. We split pretty much all the time. Mm-hmm. Like that, you know, to take one, we practice every day. So to take one tape that Michael had a great game and said Michael always won, that's not true. The battles were me against Karl Malone trying to prove he was the best power forward. You had David against Patrick, who was trying to prove the best center. You know, Clyde and Michael hated each other. They were trying to kill each other. And if you remember correctly, Scottie had shut Magic down during the finals.
Yep, 91 finals.
So that's what made the practices so incredible. And you can call it pride, ego, or whatever. We were all trying to prove our point, who was the best at their position. It's by far and away the most intense thing I've ever been through. Not one day, every day. But it was awesome because the guys had such ultimate respect for each other. Once practice was over, we went back and played. Me, Michael, Scotty, and Magic played cards every night. Bird and Ewing became great friends. We even made up T-shirts for them, but they became such close friends. But
the Odd Couple, yeah.
Well, it was awesome.
The late night card games. So you're telling me this has been written about Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Charles Barkley, Magic Johnson, late night card games. What are you playing? How much money is at stake? And who else is in the room? Because I can tell you, every NBA fan my age would pay as much as reasonably possible to be a fly on the wall for one night of that. So just please let me be a fly on the wall for one night of that.
Well, we're playing Tunk. We're playing Tunk, and there's probably $50,000 to $100,000 on the table. Same thing it was on every plane flight.
Yeah.
Flight. I mean, it was, but there was nobody else in the room. It was just us four.
That's it.
That was it. Because like everybody else had to do their own thing, but we did it every night, and we play until some had to go get a power nap in and go practice. But we did it like every night. But it was at least $50,000 to $100,000 on the table every night.
There's three historically great trash talkers at that table, and Scottie Pippen. Could Scottie hang in the trash talk? Did he just sit back and take it? Is he a better trash talker than I might know?
First of all, I don't remember. Number one, I don't really think I'm that much of a trash talker.
Well, just talker. Just you're a good talker.
Yeah, but Magic does. Michael is the greatest. Michael, Reggie, Gary Payton, Larry Bird. Those guys, as far as basketball, are the four greatest trash talkers I've ever been around. But no, listen, we were just telling stories. I mean, because, you know, Magic played with Kareem, Worthy, and those guys. You know, Michael, you know, we just talked about players. But, man, it was a really cool thing because, you know, Zach, I got to say something because I played in 96 and it wasn't a lot of fun for me because guys were complaining about playing time. Guys were complaining who was starting. So I really did not enjoy 96 because I tell people, because I remember telling Lennon Wilkins in 96 at the Olympics, I said, yo, man, this is not nearly as much fun as 92 because we had no issues in 92 whatsoever. I mean, we played cards every night. We played golf a lot. Me, Michael, and David played a lot of golf with Chuck Daly. But we had no issues. But 96 was totally different. Guys were bitching and complaining about playing time. It wasn't a lot of fun for me. The only good thing about it was in the States, in Atlanta. So I had a lot of my family and friends come over from Leeds, Alabama. But it was totally different than 92, 96.
Jack McCallum, who is the chief chronicler of the Dream Team, he's written a lot about it. Obviously, he wrote a book about it. He's rereading some of the Monte Carlo stuff to interview you. He said, you know, the guys would hit the casinos too because that's what guys do. And Charles was having such a good night one night that he hit on 19 and busted. You did not hit on 19. Is that true?
I don't even remember that. But that's first of all, I must have been really, you know, the one thing we remember about Monte Carlo. First of all, I don't remember hitting on 19. So the one thing I remember about Monte Carlo, and I still joke about it even to this day, I said, anybody who's an alcoholic should go to Monte Carlo. I says, so we go out one night with Prince Andrew.
Sure. Why not?
So we get the bill, and it's a gazillion dollars. And we like, hey, we think it's something going on with our bill, blah, blah, blah. She says, and we said, so, well, how much is a beer? She's like, $23. We're like, what? And she's like, yeah, beers are $23 here. And we had drunk almost a case of beer. We were drinking champagne and alcohol. But I tell people, man, if you got a drinking problem, go to Monte Carlo. You'll run out of money really quick. Because I talked to another couple guys on the Olympic team, like, in the last 5 or 6 to 10 years. They're like, I said, how much is beer in Monte Carlo now? They're like, oh, it's like $26. I'm like, man, in our day, it was like 21, 23, somewhere in there. It was crazy prices over there. Beautiful country, though.
So let me ask you, so you were talking about hanging out with your crew. I was reading about the trade, and now your trade to Phoenix and Phil, you talked about being, you know, on the cover of Sporting News with 6 different uniforms on. At one point, you're quoted as saying about all of the trade speculation, you know, the quote I saw was, we're not slaves. And I feel it's distasteful for me that I'm treated like a stud, like the owner of the team, Harold Katz, is putting us out, you know, for the highest bidder. And so I want to flash forward to now where, back then in your day, you're on long-term contracts for a gazillion years. The teams have total control over you for a gazillion years. Now we've flipped all the way the other way, where player empowerment is a thing and guys are on short-term contracts and they go wherever they want. And so, but a lot of people in your generation are now in the media. And so when guys go where they want, they're exercising that player power that you guys wish you had back in the day. But if they don't go to the right place, like Kevin Durant goes to Golden State, he gets hammered for it. So I guess, is there a dissonance there? Is there a disconnect there between guys in your generation wish they had that power, but then some guys now have it and exercise it, and then they don't exercise it in what you perceive as the right way? They gang up or join up a super team or whatever it is.
Well, I'm never going to be happy with that. Like, when I was going to demand to get traded, I didn't say, number one, I never got the letter away, but I didn't say I'm going to play Chicago, Boston, or the Lakers. I said, hey, man, I just want to go to a team where I got a chance to compete. I think the thing that bothered guys about my generation is these guys don't want to compete. The one actually cool thing about, and they finally got around to it watching the documentary last night, Michael did have some competition. I mean, you know, he had some great battles with the Knicks, the Pacers, obviously the Jazz and us. I says, hey, you know, all us teams won a couple games. And if you actually go back and look at it, us against him against the Suns was the last second shot that they won, or we would have had a game 7. He hit a couple, the Jazz, he hit a couple last second shots. So that's the thing, man. You just want to compete. You can handle losing. But this thing where all these guys want to play together and dominate the league, that's always going to bother us. Because, you know, I see Carl, I see Reggie, I see John. We're like, yo, man, we gave it our best shot. We lost. But we didn't say, hey, man, let's all gang up together. And I'm never going to be happy with that.
You did take a pay cut, though, so the Rockets could get Scotty.
Yeah, and that was because what happened was, number one, I wouldn't even count that as a championship. I'm not even going to lie. Like, me and Carl Malone, like, if they had won a championship with the Lakers, that doesn't count. But, you know, the Rockets called me, and Scotty wanted to try to win without Michael. But, first of all, that was never going to happen because he had a really good team in Portland. If he wasn't going to win with that team, he was never going to win without Michael.
And, boy, did they get close. Whew, that is an all-time Game 7. Whew.
Yeah, but they all of us got close, but we couldn't finish. But, you know, it was frustrating because I couldn't play anymore. Keem couldn't play anymore. Clyde couldn't play anymore. And Scotty knew it right away. So he's like, hey, I appreciate you taking the pay cut for me, but I'm getting the hell out of here. So I said, hey, listen, man, you do what you got to do.
How's your relationship today? Because you guys, there were words exchanged in the media back in the day when the Houston situation went bad. He called you the F word, F-A-T, and things like that. How are you guys today?
We're fine. You know, listen, man, I like Scotty. He's a good player. But I just, you know, listen, he didn't have the Michael Jordan cover. Like, the rest of us have to do our own thing. And he realized right away, like, I got three old guys and we're not going to win. So, like I say, I have no problem with him going to Portland.
Well, I had forgotten, speaking of being old guys, I had forgotten in 95. So everyone always focuses on the 93 Suns because you had the best record in the league. You got to the finals, took Michael almost to the limit. 94 and 95, you guys are still really freaking good. And two years in a row, you lose to Houston in game seven in the second round of the playoffs. And I'm watching those old games. And, you know, I was 17, 18, 16 around that time. So I watched them all at the time. And, like, what Hakeem was doing to your centers was like a war crime. I mean, it was like in violation of the Geneva Convention. That dude was so good.
Yeah, you know, and I tell people, I says, listen, I had 3 years to win the championship. And we lost to the champion 3 years in a row because clearly us and the Rockets were the two best teams in the league. Whoever won that series was going to win the whole thing. And I tell people, like, Akeem, you know, like, if you have a game plan where you says, I want this dude to do this. I want this guy to go left, right, get behind the backboard and shoot a fadeaway. You're like, yeah, let's make him take that shot. And a team does that dream shake. You're like, wait, nobody does that. The guy is going left, going right, spinning, and he's behind the backboard, and he's making this shot. And you're like, that's unguardable. And it was unguardable. And he was great defensively also. But, you know, it was Hakeem was unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, their whole offense for both of those title runs was essentially 4 3-point shooters, throw the ball to Hakeem. He either shoots or you hard double him and you just hope that someone misses or he throws the ball away. I mean, it was a very simple offense, but Hakeem was good enough to carry it.
Well, but I think they role players, they had really interesting role players because one game it was Vernon Maxwell. One game it was Clyde. One game it was Sam Cassell. One game it was Mario Elie. Like, you just – especially in a seven-game series. Like, I saw Reggie talking about it last night. A seven-game series is just a crapshoot. And Mario Elie hit a wide-open three to win one of those series.
Game seven, 95.
Yeah, it's just a crapshoot. But, you know, they had a really interesting mix of guys that, like, one game – because, you know, your stars are going to win you – two or three other games. But you need one guy to have one good game or a couple guys have a couple good games here or there. And that's the difference in a seven-game series. And that's all I can say about it.
Well, Cassell had 22 in Game 7 in 94. For him to come in as a rookie and be a badass in the playoffs that year, that's, like, really, really unusual. But I don't want to talk about Sam Cassell because we're running out of time. I want to go rapid fire. Who should win MVP of the NBA this year?
Giannis.
Okay. Who was your title pick before we shut the league down or suspended the season?
The Clippers.
Me too. That's been my pick all year. Yeah. So I guess Kawhi would be an example of a guy who exercised his power as a free agent – but did it in a way that falls into the middle ground where everyone – he's not teaming up with too many guys in your – I mean, he demands they get another guy and they bring in Paul, but it seems like that one falls in the sweet spot of everyone's kind of okay with that.
Well, because I think that he's did it by himself before. I think we give him, like, number one, he did it with the Spurs as a role player, but then what he did up in Toronto – he gets a pass. Now to join a team of supers when you ain't done anything, that is what we frown upon.
Do you still think they should cancel the season?
I do. I don't know if it's safe, and that's my number one thing. You know, Zach, my number one thing, I love my players. I'm a player first no matter what. And what scares me is if one of these guys gets sick, God forbid they get one of their kids sick and something bad happens, or a wife or a girlfriend or a mom and dad or a grandparent. And that's what scares me the most, You know, and these guys are talking about keeping guys at a hotel for 2 months. I'm like, are they going to keep the maids at the hotel for 2 months? Are they going to keep the room service people at a hotel for 2 months? I just don't want to see anything bad happen. I mean, you see now this thing is killing kids in New York.
That's scary.
I would hate to see one of these guys. I mean, listen, all these guys, some of these guys are young, got young kids. And listen, I don't understand how much money is at stake. I'm not an idiot or a moron. I know there's a lot of money at stake. But, man, I would hate to see one of these guys get sick and get somebody in their family sick.
I think the NBA's argument, and I would be interested to hear your take on it, is, yes, they're concerned about that kind of risk. They're concerned about, you know, we have coaches who are 70 years old, all of that. Those risks are going to be there in broader society as it reopens to whatever degree until there is a vaccine or some other treatment that can numb the effect of the virus very quickly before it gets serious. I think some people within the league would say, given that reality outside the NBA, Mike D'Antoni, I'm just using his name because he's an older coach, assumes that same risk going to the grocery store. So if your standard is the standard by which the NBA must govern itself, then they're taken to an extreme. They would say, well, then we just have no NBA until there's a vaccine. Then we just have to wait because we can't run a business. It's persuasive to me a little bit. It's there's no right answer.
Well, let me say this. Number one, first of all, I've always been a proponent that we should start the season in December.
Mm-hmm.
Because the year we had to strike was our highest ratings ever. And people want to say, well, it's because they missed basketball. I said, that's not true at all. First of all, you alienate and piss off more fans not playing, so that would hurt your ratings or whatever. I said, what happened was, listen, college football and pro football are King Kong. If you move away from those two sports, and we complain about a load management. If you want to do something about load management, go to 70 games or 75 games. But get away from college and pro football, except the only thing you got to really worry about in December is the playoffs. But let me go back and push back a little bit on your first point. They are going to the grocery store for guys like that, but how are we going to sit on the bench together? Are we going to practice social distancing sitting on the bench?
Yes, I think.
Yeah, but that's going to make it. But also, how do we social distance in the post or at the free throw line? And also, you're confining these guys more. Like when you go to the supermarket, you can stay away from people. But when you're in the huddle or, you know, you got a guy at the free throw line, you standing next to a guy or a guy who wrestles with a guy in the post. And then when he goes to the bench, the coach says, hey, come here, I need to tell you something. And he's talking to him in his ear because there's no noise in the arena. Everybody can hear what he said. He's going to get really close to him. Like I say, hey, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm not even going to lie. If they play, they play. If they don't, they don't. I just hate, and let's be realistic, it's all about money. It's always all about money in sport. And I would hate to see one of my players or somebody in their family. Oh, another thing, let me ask you this. What if Giannis, LeBron, Anthony Davis, Kawhi, Paul George, James Harden, Russell, what if one of those guys get the virus in the first round of the playoffs?
You treat it like they – what if they sprained their ankle in the first round of the playoffs? That's what you just have to treat it like. Like if you're going to be dissuaded by that.
If the Milwaukee Bucks lost in the first round of the playoffs because Giannis had the virus, first of all, do you sequester the whole team or do you keep going? Like there's stuff like that I think we like, wait, if we get to the finals and there's no LeBron, that ain't right. That ain't fair. And that's the only thing that worries me. I said, wait a minute. If Kawhi and Paul George got the virus and they can't play and the Clippers losing the first round of the playoffs, that's not, to me, those are my only concerns.
Right. So that's where the asterisk comes in and all that. But then I think the NBA would counter, well, when is that not going to be a risk? And are you arguing that we really actually should shut down the league until like that, until we have a total handle on the virus? Because that could be a while.
I think by next year, like even if we don't wait to December, even if we wait, start regular like we do in October now, we'll have a much better idea if this, because now we got to figure in these states opening. So I think we're going to know a lot more in the next month.
Yes.
Than we got, because, you know, I'm watching the news this morning, like, I think 48 states are opening up today. And I'm going to be real curious how this going to happen. Like, I'll know a lot more in a month how this thing is going to work out. And we're just going to be starting in a month. Because I heard the players say they want a month to practice. So, first of all, I don't think they're going to get a month if we go back and play. But everybody's going back to opening up these states, and then we're just going to jump in. And that just concerns me.
I think it's fair. I think your concerns are fair. These are really difficult choices. And like you said, we're going to see a lot about what happens. But we've gone an hour. That's our time limit. I'm thrilled you came on. We'll have to do it again sometime because we got to talk. There's all sorts of stuff on my list we didn't talk about, including politics and all that. But we'll do it again sometime. Charles Barkley, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure watching you on TV. It was a pleasure watching you play growing up. Thanks for the time.
Hey, man, thank you. Keep up the great work. I will look like I'm on. Wait, so let me ask you a question. This is another question.
Okay.
So are y'all going to be able to go to games?
Should I get my wife down here to answer that question with me? Because that's going to be a joint decision, I think.
We're talking about players and everything. My question is a very fair question. I don't even know if you know the answer. So are y'all going to have to do virtual? Like, I don't even know. We haven't even got that far yet.
I think there's going to be changes to lots of stuff that lasts a long time across all segments of society and the way we do our jobs. And so I do think, if this campus environment or bubble or whatever you want to call it happens, my guess, and this is purely a guess, is that they will invite select people from certain media partners to come cover it if they want. Going forward beyond that, and you got to quarantine and do all those things that you're supposed to do, all the players are going to do. So you either want to do that or you don't. Going forward, I think it will be a while before media are in the locker room again, if ever in the next 5 years. I just think that kind of close, whatever, I can see a world where players come out and do their interviews in like what's happening right before the league was suspended. Like, I think us hanging around in the locker room and hovering over dudes and waiting for that moment to pounce in and get it and like just chit chatting, I think that's going to be over for a while.
Yeah. Like I say, it's interesting though. I just thought about it when you were talking, because I was getting ready. So how this conversation came up, I was getting ready to say, hey, I'll see you in the playoffs. And I'm like, maybe not. Yeah.
I don't know, but I would like to see you at an NBA game sometime before 2022. And thanks again for coming on. Stay safe, stay healthy, best to your family, and we'll see you on TV soon, man.
All right, hey, be safe. You take care of yourself.